Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for December 30, 2004. This is Doug Henwin, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I'm coming to you on recording tonight. I'm off in Massachusetts celebrating the holidays with my in-laws, and no cheap Penny Youngman jokes here. I'm quite fond of my in-laws. But we've got one long interview taking up almost all of the program tonight, although we'll have some art breaks along the way. That is an interview with Leslie McCall, who is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey, and the author of two recent pamphlets for the think tank Demos. One, a survey of public opinion on the issues of inequality, and the second, an examination of the contributions of corporate policy to the growth in inequality in the United States over the last couple of decades. And before we get into listening to the interview with Leslie McCall, just a bit of a historical scene setting here. From roughly the time of the 1930s depression through the end of the 1960s or beginning of the 1970s, income and inequality in the U.S. was on a pretty steady decline. It had reached the point in the 1960s where economists began to develop the theory that as economies matured, their early bouts of inequality would disappear, and certainly inequality increased with the advent of capitalism, but the theory was as capitalism matured, then inequality would reduce and the middle classes and the poorer folks would actually start getting more and more of a share of the bounty that capitalism was undeniably capable of producing. But somewhere between 1967 and 73, depending upon how you want to measure this, inequality in the United States bottomed out. That is to say, we had the most egalitarian distribution of income that we had in our modern history, and it's been getting more and more unequal pretty much without interruption ever since. True in good times and bad, throughout the 80s and 90s long expansions, and even by some measures over the last couple of years, even though the stock market hadn't been doing so great for 2001, 2002. Rich people have been doing the best of all in this so-called economic recovery, which doesn't feel like much of an economic recovery, while average workers have been doing much less well. Now, sometimes in the 80s and even sometimes in the 90s, we had inequality rising as a political issue, but it didn't really take off in a big way. And so that's one of the things I wanted to talk with Leslie McCall about. She's studied the public opinion evidence and has also been extensively involved in studying the causes of inequality in the United States. So let's begin with the first portion of the interview, which is all about the American public opinion towards inequality. First of all, let's start by talking a little bit about public attitude towards inequality. The common belief, and I've believed this myself, is that Americans really don't care so much about it, that we accept a certain level of inequality as kind of natural, whatever that means, conducive to prosperity, and that a certain Protestant idea that, you know, skill and virtue and work are rewarded and laziness is punished, and the distribution of incomes sort of represents that. Actually, you've been studying the public opinion on inequality, and it's a little more complicated than that, right?
Right, yes it is. It is a common misperception that Americans don't care about inequality, but it's also actually, let me just add, it's not only a common misperception that Americans don't care about inequality, but also that American attitudes don't change about inequality, that Americans just simply have one view towards inequality and that's it, and it's compared to Europeans who are intolerant of inequality. And I think both of those are misconceptions. First, most Americans, over half of Americans, do tend to view inequality as too large, as that there's too much inequality, that the income differences between the rich and poor are too great. So we're talking here over 50%, 50 to 60% of the population at various points in time tend to think that there is too much inequality. At the same time, this changes as well and has changed over time, particularly at a few periods that I've looked at in the 1990s. The opposition to inequality, the view that there's too much inequality, that income differences are too large, increased, particularly during the recession of the early 1990s and 1992. And then also, surprisingly, in the mid-1990s, in 1995, 1996, when supposedly the economy was doing better. So we can't say that these attitudes about inequality or intolerance of the level of inequality is due simply to the recession. At these two points in time, opposition, strong opposition to inequality peaked around 60-65%. Now, there are various reasons for why these changes took place. My theory is that during the early 1990s and the mid-1990s, there was a lot of focus on problems, structural, in particular structural problems with the economy. In the early 1990s, it wasn't just the recession of 1991-1992 that captured Americans' ideas about inequality, but that there were the particular scandals that had to do with excessive executive pay that were similar in some ways to the corporate scandals of the early part of this decade. But instead of the sort of corporate scandals of today did not focus on inequality, whereas in the early 1990s, the focus was explicitly on excessive executive pay and excessive executive pay relative to the average worker, number one. And number two, that this was hurting our economy because it was coming at a time of economic recession. So that was really quite important at that time, I think, in driving attitudes against the high levels of inequality that we have in this country. And then I think even more interesting was in the mid-1990s, during the quote-unquote jobless recovery, there was a lot of attention to issues such as downsizing that affected middle-class workers and middle-class families. And there was coverage of the economy that was, as I said, critical of the structural changes that had taken place, such as downsizing, during a time of economic expansion. And I think this created, justifiably, concerns on the part of a large number of Americans who viewed inequality as not necessary, clearly, for economic prosperity. So the view that inequality creates economic growth and fuels the American economic engine was really questioned at this time, because there was economic growth, yet it was very moderate. There was job loss at the same time. The American economy had not taken off like it had in the late 1990s yet. And there was a lot of anxiety and insecurity and concern among middle-class Americans.
And now we have, in the late 90s, we had the rich were getting richer, but real wages were rising. People in the middle and lower brackets were doing reasonably well. That all ended with the recession of 2001. And people at the top have been doing okay, but people in the middle and lower levels have been struggling. What do you know, can you tell about attitudes about inequality today?
Well, the little that I do know is really somewhat impressionistic. And this is because the data sources that I've been using to talk about American attitudes about inequality so far are really not available for the early part of this decade. Unfortunately, the questions that I had been looking at and the surveys that I had been looking at have not been asked again recently. But from the questions that I have been able to look at, I think what's going on here is that there is, of course, continued concern about the economy and levels of inequality, but there is a residual amount of optimism about the economy, a sort of faith in the level of economic growth that this country had in the late 1990s. So there's some sense that Americans do want to put sort of faith in the economy, faith in economic growth, faith in the equalizing potential of economic growth. And I think that they clearly did that in the late 1990s, according to the surveys that I've looked at. And I think there's just a lingering amount of optimism as a result of the late 1990s boom. It's not particularly accurate, because levels of inequality are as high now as they were before World War II. So we're talking about continuing extraordinarily high levels of inequality that moderated clearly. I mean, they leveled off in the late 1990s, and they are starting to expand a bit more now, but they're still high, and this sort of high level of inequality I don't think is gaining as much attention as it should.
And you mentioned that Americans sometimes think that economic growth is enough to reduce inequality. That's plainly not the case, right? Is that correct?
Yes, yes. I mean, this is, I think, probably the most interesting aspect of this issue, and that is that it was probably accurate at one point. In fact, it was accurate at one point in time up until the 1970s that economic growth was equalizing. And I think Americans have continued to continue to think that that's the case when it clearly isn't. We had extraordinary growth in the late 1990s. That's true. In fact, it was much better than it was in the 1980s and early 1990s. But it still, as I just said, it still was not enough to reduce the level of inequality back to where it was in the 1960s and 1970s. So economic growth is no longer equalizing. It used to be equalizing. And unfortunately, American perceptions of economic growth haven't caught up with reality.
And, of course, we're in the middle of a Christmas season in which Walmart is struggling and Tiffany's is thriving. So they have this living symbol of the polarization of American society. And people do, over time, even at times when they're less concerned about it, it's over 50% of the public is concerned about this as an issue, as you've discovered. But why has inequality never really taken on salience as a political issue? And why do we keep electing candidates to office who will either do nothing about it or make it worse?
Well, that's a great question. I think that one issue, I certainly don't have the whole answer to this, but I think one issue has to do with, and I'm here going to talk about it as an issue that has some kind of appeal or traction to the popular imagination, to the public. I'm sure there are other sort of political reasons why politicians don't want to talk about inequality, but I'm going to leave that aside for the moment. I think the issue of inequality is an extremely abstract one. I don't think it's an easy one to discuss. I think the reason why there was increased opposition to inequality in the 1990s, as I said, was because there were specific issues that highlighted or that were examples, that were easy to understand and accessible examples of inequality, such as the excessive executive pay and executive pay gap and downsizing. I think these were two huge issues that received a lot of press attention that people could identify with. They were easy to understand. They weren't to talk about downsizing and excessive executive pay wasn't necessarily to talk about inequality. You could talk about those issues without talking about inequality per se. But they were clearly related to inequality. And I think that they're a good way to talk about the issues. Now, the corporate scandal certainly provided an opportunity to talk about inequality in a very accessible way, but that did not happen, unfortunately. And I think that that's one of the big issues, is being able to find examples of, very accessible examples of inequality, and to highlight those. Both politicians need to highlight them and the media needs to highlight them as well.
Now, it's also a cliche, and I was just reading this in a study of American class structures the other day, that Americans who are tired of the working class see the only way out is to become self-employed, to become a business person themselves, and don't really look to a political solution to the situation, either political in the sense of voting for candidates or political in the sense of organizing unions or whatever. Is this a correct perception, do you think?
Well, you know, it does, of course, it is, of course, very consistent with the notion that Americans see individual routes to success. They don't see kind of structural or political routes to economic success. But I think it also is, if I can continue on this theme of inequality being a very abstract concept, I think it's also indicative of the fact that that Americans don't tend to make a connection between the economy and problems with the economy and government solutions to those problems with the economy on the one hand. So they don't think that the government can actually intervene in a constructive way in the economy. So that's, I think, one set of issues. The other set is that Americans don't tend to put or to connect certain kinds of policies with inequality, certain kinds of policies such as taxation. So if you were to ask Americans, you know, what would be the best government policy to reduce inequality, I don't think that they would, the first thing that they would say would be taxes, a form of progressive taxation or tax reform that creates a more progressive form of taxation. So that, I think, is another issue that I think it derives from the complexity and abstractness of inequality, that Americans don't typically see the connection between economic inequality and various forms of government policy, not only taxation policy, but also policies such as the minimum wage, raising the minimum wage, and also making it easier to organize workers' associations and unions.
Weirdly, it was the two states passed an increase in their minimum wage at the last election, Florida and Nevada, and Bush carried both of them. So Americans don't always think very systematically about politics, I don't think. I'm speaking with Leslie McCall, who teaches sociology and women's studies at Rutgers University. I was surprised to see one of the opinion polls you review shows, I think it was a Gallup poll, showing strong support for redistribution of income from richer to poorer people, but the government is not mentioned by name. So, but the people don't have a deep-seated, at least philosophical, objection to the idea of redistribution.
Yes. I think that there is an important distinction here. Americans do favor redistribution in the abstract. They do not favor as much government intervening to reduce the gaps between the rich and the poor. There is even less support when you ask about specific policies such as welfare reform. So the more specific you get about the government intervention in closing the gap between the rich and the poor, the less support that you get. However, there is a surprising amount of support for things like raising the minimum wage. And there is a large number of Americans, well over majority, think that certain types of occupations are underpaid, such as teachers and nurses, for example, and that other kinds of occupations are overpaid, such as CEOs and athletes and entertainment stars and so on. So if you ask the questions about the government's role in particular, and there are certain issues that Americans have very negative attitudes about, and those tend to have to do with specifically with welfare programs. But once you get away from welfare and you ask questions about particularly programs that provide what's called equality of opportunity, such as job training and that sort of thing, Americans tend to be very supportive of those programs. They also tend to be very supportive of increasing taxes on the rich. So in the abstract, when you're asking these questions, Americans tend to be very supportive of redistributive type policies. However, when it comes to actually voting for candidates that might espouse these kinds of policies, then as we all know, there hasn't been as much support.
Now let's move on from talking about opinion to causes. The standard explanation among economists for increasing inequality is technological change and what they call increasing returns to skill. That is, education. People with educations and a lot of experience are going to get paid more than people without them. I think at the popular level, the standard explanation is trade. It's just all cheap goods coming from China. What's your reaction, first of all, to these explanations? And second of all, what do you think is really going on?
Okay, well, I think there are a couple of ways of thinking about this. Economists do agree that there are other explanations of rising inequality. It's just that up until this point, they've thought that those are secondary explanations. And I happen to think that they're actually more than secondary. They probably should be moved up to the primary category. And those are what are called institutional explanations. So the two primary kinds of institutional explanations that economists think are, in fact, a factor in the rising level of inequality are, one, the minimum wage, that is the sort of declining real value, purchasing power of the minimum wage, and the decline in unions. Both of these are seen as rather significant sources of rising inequality. The minimum wage in particular is an extremely important source of inequality for rising, source of rising inequality among women, because women are much more likely to be minimum wage workers than are men. Unionization, on the other hand, is a much more important determinant of rising inequality among men. So if you simply look at explanations for rising inequality among men, you may have a case for the importance of trade, for example. But if you look at the rate of rising inequality among women, trade becomes a less important factor. These sort of institutional explanations, I think, have been very prominent. But there's another sort of what would be called an institutional explanation that hasn't received as much attention as I think it should, and I think it's extremely, in fact, extremely important. It's just that it's very hard to measure, and that is changes in corporate practices. It's often argued that corporations decided to downsize and lay off workers and reduce the role of unions and so on as a result of increasing competition from overseas and as a result of technological pressures. However, if you go back and look at why corporations decided to restructure and downsize and the reasons that were given at the time, this is in the late 70s, early 1980s, actually were not only a result of increasing trade and increasing technological pressures. They were actually the result of large institutional investors, owners of capital, putting pressure on corporations to increase their stock market value. This is kind of known as the first sort of shareholder revolution. We talk about the shareholder revolution of today, but the first shareholder revolution was launched by large institutional investors and corporate raiders as well. And they wanted better returns, essentially, on their investments in corporations, which it's well known that the stock market was at a low point in the 1970s. So it's not surprising that they would seek greater returns to their investments at this time. But what's most interesting is that when they were seeking to increase their returns on their stock market investments, they didn't cite the need for restructuring because of increasing global competition. They didn't cite the need for increasing returns to stocks because of increasing technological pressures. What they cited was gross mismanagement by CEOs and top executives. They claimed that American corporations were mismanaged, that there was too much emphasis on growth. In fact, that executives and managers were too easy on their workers. They had too, you know, we hear a lot of talk about the cozy relationships between CEOs and boards of directors now. But this was a major claim back in the late 1970s and early 1980s that managers, CEOs, top executives were too close to their boards of directors, they could get away with anything. And also, interestingly, that they were too close to their own employees, okay? That they were too protective of their employees, that they were not responsible enough to the owners of the corporation and were more responsible, in fact, to the employees of the corporation and therefore were reluctant to, for example, engage in mass layoffs or downsizing or subcontracting out work or turning
to even talking about social missions for corporations in the 70s.
Yes. It was a whole type of rhetoric around, corporate style, really welfare, that American managers were engaged in a sort of welfare project for their employees, that benefits were too large, and that workers at the bottom in particular that were unskilled were unnecessary, that they should be subcontracted out to temp agencies and so on, and therefore that would really lower the cost, the overhead cost, for example, of those employees because you wouldn't have to pay them benefits. So there was this idea that there were, in fact, equity norms, quote-unquote, in the corporation, in which this was
equity in the sense of justice and not
yes,
stock.
Yes, exactly. Equity in the sense of justice, that corporate corporations were actually concerned about the gap in pay between the top and the bottom, and there was an attempt to minimize that in order to foster greater loyalty, which in turn would reduce turnover, would increase productivity, and so on. This was a culture that was endorsed by the top corporations, and by the way. This was the sort of reigning ideology, that is, equity norms was the reigning ideology during the height of industrial capitalism in the 1960s, in which you had very high growth rates, economic growth rates, high productivity rates, low unemployment, and so on.
Yeah, and if you read some of the documents at that time, we're talking about more or less mainstream things like Galbraith's New Industrial State or radical things like Baron and Sweezy's monopoly capital, it was like, profit maximization had ceased to be the driving force that it had been in earlier capitalism. It was kind of techno-structure, and it was a very different world from what we'd come to think of capitalism as.
Right. That's right. And the whole structure of the corporation was, I mean, in a sense, the corporation was a mini-economy itself, and it had the kind of control within its boundaries it also had the flexibility to do this as well, because there were large extended corporations. But it had the kind of control to set pay, sort of pay structures in a way that was somewhat insulated from the external economy. To a certain extent, that was a factor in the decline of American corporations and American competitiveness in the 1970s, but only to a certain extent. It wasn't the whole picture.
And that was the first portion of an interview with Leslie McCall, who is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey, author of two pamphlets for the Demos think tank, which is based here in New York. You can get these pamphlets, download them from the Demos website, and learn everything you ever wanted to know about Demos itself by visiting their website at demos-usa.org, demos-usa.org. And now let's take a little break for the station ID.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over. And there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
And we're back. This is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And now, before listening to the second portion of the interview with Leslie McCall, let's listen to this bit of musical entertainment from the Mekons, their song City of London.
Putting gas into this battered old
And that was the Mekon song City of London from their album Journey to the End of the Night. And now let's listen to the second portion of an interview recorded early last week with Leslie McCall, who is a fellow at the Demos Institute. And you can get to her papers by visiting the Demos website. She also teaches sociology and women's studies at Rutgers University, author of a book called Complex Inequality, Leslie McCall. And so what happened to shake up the world of the man in the gray flannel suit?
As I said, there were a number of causes, but I think that the primary one was this sort of sense that corporations were becoming, in David Gordon's, not exactly in David Gordon's words. David Gordon has this book called Fat and Mean, which was supposed to be a counter to the Lean and Mean. Bennett Harrison's Lean and Mean. But before all of that, there was sort of fat and nice, I guess. the corporations of the 1970s were fat and nice. They treated their employees too well, and this wasted costs, and therefore there had to be these kinds of massive restructurings that cut costs by laying off workers and outright laying off or subcontracting to temp agencies and other kinds of business service intermediaries. Now, at the same time, though, top managers and CEOs were rewarded handsomely for these restructurings. So the idea that corporations had to become lean and mean, this is what David Gordon questioned, corporations didn't exactly become lean and mean. They became lean and mean for the mid-level and low-level employees, but they continued to be fat for the high-level executives and managers. In fact, executives, there's all of this controversy now, or at least, you know, starting a couple years ago about excessive CEO pay, and all of the sort of stock options that CEOs have built into their compensation packages. But that all started in effect as an incentive system for CEOs back in the early 1980s. It was argued at the time that that managers, as I said, were not paying enough attention to increasing returns on stocks. And so the way to make managers more attuned to the interests of the owners of capital was to pepper their compensation packages with incentives to increase the stock market value of the corporation. And the way they did that was to make part of their compensation package based on stock options. So CEOs, so the sort of origins of stock options as a major part of CEO packages was back during this first shareholder revolution, so that CEOs were compensate him handsomely for not only these massive restructurings and taking the quote-unquote risk for mass layoffs and downsizings and this kind of shedding of whole divisions and so on that weren't related to the core competencies of the corporation, they were also given these incentives to pay more attention to the returns from stocks. So what's interesting about this period is not that the corporation was becoming lean for everyone. It was only becoming lean for part of the corporation, for the mid and low levels, but also, in fact, for mid-level managers. If you weren't a core member of the corporation, then you were likely to be vulnerable to downsizings, even if, for example, you were a corporate lawyer. The services that you provided were not firm specific. You also could be downsized, laid off, and a kind of temp agency for lawyers could be hired instead. So the sort of security at the mid-level and below that workers had just evaporated. But a lot of the costs, quote unquote, that were saved as a result were simply redistributed up to the top. To increase the pay of senior executives and management.
I was speaking with Leslie McCall, a professor of sociology and women's studies at Rutgers. Earlier, when you were talking about the risks or compensating the CEOs for the risks they take, you put air quotes around risks, and of course the radio audience couldn't see that, but why did you do that?
Because the the CEOs, I think we now know, of course, CEOs have always taken risks. This is not something that I'm not trying to suggest that CEOs do not have a tough job, that they don't. That they're not under a lot of pressure, that they don't take risks and so on. But the question of whether or not those risks had increased at this point, I think, is really an open one. In particular, the kinds of packages that were given to CEOs in order to compensate for such risks, such as radical restructurings, which is what we're talking about here, included things like golden parachutes, and these are compensation. This is compensation that would be given to a CEO if 2 or 3 years down the line, after they've been hired to radically restructure the corporation, the performance of the corporation takes a dive anyway. So they took this quote unquote risk with the corporation, but there was certainly no theory or evidence that would support the fact that these risks would increase performance. In some cases they did, in some cases they didn't. We know from research that CEO pay is not, in fact, related to increased performance. There isn't a positive relationship there. So I think it's sensible to reward CEOs for legitimate risks, but these clearly were not legitimate risks. And the compensation that they received as a result, I think, was well beyond what was warranted. And we still see today these extraordinary, extraordinary compensation packages for CEOs in the event that the corporation will be taken over, that there will be some kind of hostile takeover. And there really seems to be no legitimate reason why these executives should be getting these kinds of compensation packages. I believe the latest example of this was Merck, and there, as far as I know, I don't know all of the details, but there was a lot of rumbling by the employees of that corporation about the golden parachute type packages that the executives would get if the corporation would be taken over.
So let's just make this phrases as provocatively and succinctly as possible. Your argument is that a good deal of the increase in inequality in this country over the last couple of decades comes from pressures coming from Wall Street to get stock prices up. And what that means is that corporations initiated the very familiar round of downsizings, the perpetual wage squeeze, the increase in the insecurity that people experience, and also at the same time awarded themselves very large pay packages. So this is what share of the increase in inequality, I'm not asking you to put a number on this, but how much of a factor is this in the whole increase in inequality since the late 60s, early 70s?
Unfortunately, we can't put a number on it. I would love to be able to put a number on it, but we don't have the kind of data that we need in order to put a number on it. But we do have certain kinds of data that certainly point to the importance of these changes. First of all, we know that there has been an extraordinary concentration of income and wealth at the very top of the income distribution. We're talking about the top 1%, the top half.
We're not talking about the upper middle class. We're talking about the very top.
We are talking about the very top, yes. And you know, earlier I said that inequality had leveled off in the late 1990s as a result of the economic boom. I was talking about inequality between, say, families at the 90th percentile and those at the 10th percentile of the income distribution. That is, sort of at the top is the 90th and the bottom would be the 10th percentile. But inequality between...
So that's like 200,000 versus the 10 to 15,000, right?
Right, exactly. But inequality between families in the top 1% of the distribution and everyone else continued to increase in the late 1990s and has increased dramatically since the 1970s. That really cannot be explained by increasing trade competition. That cannot be explained by increasing technological advances. These are factors that really... don't touch the tippity top of the income distribution the way that changes in executive pay do. So we know that this has to be an important factor, and a factor that's, you know, fairly well hidden because we don't have the kind of data that we need to accurately assess the incomes of the very top. There's really only one or two studies so far that has been able to gather the data that we need in order to understand long-term changes in the very top of the distribution and for executives as a whole.
All right, so let's move on to the there was the final portion of an interview, which is the most difficult, which is why I save it for last. What do we do about this?
Well, I'm not sure I know exactly what to do about it, but one of the things that I think is really important is to think again about changing corporate level policies. And I say again because this was something that was seen as routine throughout most of the post-war period. Since the 1970s and 80s, corporations have been given really just a free rein. The troubles with the economy that began in the 1970s, of course, the deep recession of the 1980s, as we know, the jobless recovery in the 1990s, all of these were seen as fundamental problems with the American economy, and corporations were given a free hand in trying to get America back on its feet, the American economy back on its feet again. Okay, so these sort of core structural problems with the economy actually led to greater independence by corporations in terms of formulating new kinds of corporate practices and so on in order to get the American economy going again. Well, the American economy did in fact get going again in the late 1990s, and so one view is that that it was right to let corporations restructure as extensively and as they did in the ways that they did. But another view is that that those types of restructurings were perhaps appropriate in some cases, but certainly excessive in other cases, that the restructurings went really well beyond the targeted industries that really needed them. Certainly some industries needed to be downsized, some industries decline, and other industries are, you know, become more important. And so it's not unusual to see that kind of churning and restructuring. So what I'm talking about is the extension of this policy of restructuring and downsizing and so on, redistribution of income to the top, to executives, to CEOs, the importance of Wall Street, all of that went well beyond the justifications that were based in real problems, fundamental problems with the economy in certain sectors. So at this point, we still, I think, are under the illusion that corporations are really, really need to decide how to run the economy in the most sort of lean and mean way that they can, and that that's best for American workers as well. So part of what I think is important is to cast the spotlight, the lens, back on corporations again. When most progressives talk about reducing inequality, they tend to talk about government policies, right? They tend to talk about increasing taxes on the rich, you know, redistributive sorts of policies such as increased progressive taxation. They tend to talk about increasing the minimum wage, making it easier for unions to organize, and so on. And I think those are all extremely important, and also combating some of the globalization, the extensive sort of unfair trade, and focusing more on fair trade, and so on. But corporations and corporate policies and new corporate policies have pretty much been left out of the picture in terms of discussions of change, how to reduce inequality, and how to change the current structure of the economy, which results in such high levels of inequality. So I think casting an eye back on changes in corporate policy that were not natural, are not necessarily the only kinds of changes that fit with the quote unquote new economy. I think that's a major area we need to focus on. Although all those other sorts of government policies are important, and in fact the government may have a hand in creating fairer corporate level policies, I think we need to focus more attention on the sorts of policies that corporations are enacting and continue to enact without any sort of without any consequences whatsoever. And just sort of one example of this, which isn't which is related, but I think doesn't go far enough. And that is that there is a lot of attention now to the rights of shareholders, sort of the common shareholder, that the common shareholder has been shafted.
Appropriating a rhetoric of democracy.
Yes, exactly. The common shareholder, right, has been shafted as a result of these corporate scandals. What's really fascinating is that no one talks about the common worker that's been shafted as a result of these corporate policies. It's well recognized that corporations or top corporate executives and boards of directors have not paid attention to the common shareholder. So there is a kind of admission that there are inequities and, in effect, even inefficiencies in the way corporations have been managing their quote-unquote portfolios to the benefit of the top managers and executives and boards and so on. So there's an admission of inefficiency. There's an admission of these injustices, but only vis-a-vis shareholders and not vis-a-vis employees. Now, that might be okay if shareholders and employees were the same people, but that at present, there's really very little overlap between employees and shareholders.
All right. I think that'll do. Thank you very much for joining us, Leslie. And that was Leslie McCall, who is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Rutgers University, author of two papers available on the Demos website. She is a fellow at Demos Institute, a think tank here in New York City, and their website is demos-usa.org, demos-usa.org. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. I'll be back live next week, and let's go out with this collaboration between Allen Ginsberg reading his poem America with musical background supplied by Tom Waits. Bye.
America. America, I've given you all, and now I'm nothing. America, $2.27, January 17th, 1956. I can't stand my own mind. America, when will we end the human war? Go fuck yourself with your atom bomb. I don't feel good, don't bother me. I won't write my poem till I'm in my right mind. America, when will you be angelic? When will you take off your clothes? When will you look at yourself through the grave? When will you be worthy of your million Trotskyites? America, why are your libraries full of tears? America, when will you send your eggs to India? I'm sick of your insane demands. When can I go into the supermarket and buy what I need with my good looks? America, after all, it is you and I who are perfect, not the next world. Your machinery is too much for me. You made me want to be a saint. There must be some other way to settle this argument. Burroughs is in Tangiers. I don't think he'll come back. Sinister. Are you being sinister, or is this some form of practical joke? I'm trying to come to the point. I refuse to give up my obsession. America, stop pushing. I know what I'm doing. America, the plum blossoms are falling. I haven't read the newspapers for months. Every day somebody goes on trial for murder. America, I feel sentimental about the wobblies. America, I was a communist when I was a kid. I'm not sorry. I smoke marijuana every chance I get. I sit in my house for days on end and stare at the roses in the closet. Whenever I go to Chinatown, I get drunk and never get laid. My mind is made up. There's going to be trouble. You should have seen me reading Marx. I have mystical visions and cosmic vibrations. America, I still haven't told you what you did to Uncle Max after he came home from Russia. I'm addressing you. Are you going to let your emotional life be run by Time magazine? I'm obsessed by Time magazine. I read it every week. Its cover stares at me every time I slink past the corner candy store. I read it in the basement of the Berkeley Public Library. It's always telling me about responsibility. Businessmen are serious. Movie producers are serious. Everybody's serious but me. It occurs to me that I am America. I'm talking to myself again. Asia is rising against me. I haven't got a Chinaman's chance. I'd better consider my national resources. My national resources consist of two joints of marijuana, millions of genitals, an unpublishable private literature that goes 1,400 mph, and 25,000 mental institutions. I say nothing about my prisons, nor the millions of underprivileged who live in my flower pots under the light of 500 suns. I have already abolished the whorehouses of France. Tangiers are the next to go. My ambition is to be president, despite the fact that I'm a Catholic. America, how can I write a holy litany in your silly mood? I will continue, like Henry Ford. My strophes are as individual as his automobiles, more so they're all different sexes. America, I will sell you strophes, 2,500 apiece, 500 down on your old strophe. America, free Tom Mooney. America, save the Spanish loyalists. America, Sacco and Vanzetti must not die. I am the Scottsboro Boys. America, when I was 7, Mama took me to communist cell meetings. They sold us garbanzos, a handful per ticket. A ticket cost a nickel and the speeches were free. Everybody was angelic and sentimental about the workers. It was all so sincere, you have no idea what a good thing the party was. In 1835, Scott Nearing was a grand old man, a real mensch. Mother Bloor made me cry. I once saw Israel Amter playing. Everybody must have been a spy. America, you don't really want to go to war. America's them bad Russians. Them Russians, and them Chinamen, and them Russians. The Russia wants to eat us alive. The Russia's power mad. She wants to take our cars from out our garages. Her wants to grab Chicago. Her needs Red Readers' digests. Her wants our auto plants in Siberia. Him big bureaucracy running our filling stations. That no good. Ugh, him make Indians learn read. Him need big black niggers. Ah. Her make us all work 16 hours a day. Help. America, this is quite serious. America, this is the impression I get from looking in the television set. America, is this correct? I'd better get right down to the job. It's true, I don't want to join the army or turn lathes and precision parts factories. I'm nearsighted and psychopathic anyway. America, I'm putting my queer shoulder to the wheel.